Thomas Randolph took his wife out to dinner for Mother's Day.
We had a theory that as they're walking together, holding hands, he knows within a very short period of time, she'd be dead on the floor in her house.
He groomed a person that would be willing to kill for him.
Think we should tell you you're under arrest?
No, because if you are, you f***ed up.
There was more that we needed to know about Tom Randolph.
We're going to have to go back through every relationship he ever had.
We went to Washington State, Indiana,
Kentucky,
New Hampshire,
Utah.
He'd been married 6 times, and 4 of his wives are dead.
Becky was shot in the head.
We had a gun in her hand. Seems like a suicide.
She would never have killed herself.
Police arrested Thomas Randolph on charges of murder.
He said, point blank, I want you to kill my wife.
These women come up dead. He comes up with money.
He's really a sick son of a bitch.
On the ground!
What
the chick done to me?
Boom, boom, boom!
Put your hands on your head right now. Put your hands on your head!
What did you do to my mother?
I love you, Tom.
Am I beautiful?
It's 2021. I never thought that we'd still be talking about Thomas Randolph, but it is definitely a story that needs to be told.
I open it up. I get right here and Sharon's laying in the floor.
It's rare that you come across somebody like a Tom Randolph where they methodically map out how they're going to take someone's life. You know, and it's chilling.
I thought I just seen like a shadow or something over this way.
I would describe Thomas Randolph as egotistical, selfish, a narcissist that cares for nothing and no one other than himself.
Sharon? Sharon!
My partner Rob Sharon. Wilson and I were investigating the murder of Sharon Randolph and Mike Miller. We had every belief that Tom Randolph had met Mike Miller, that he befriended him, that he started grooming him for what eventually occurred on May 8th of 2008.
As soon as she walked into this area here, where her head was positioned right here, Michael Miller fired that shot.
As Miller started to walk through the garage door to leave with Thomas Randolph behind him, Tom Randolph fired the first shot. He ambushed him.
Boom!
I remember her showing up to my front door with him, and I was like, where did he come from, you know? And then I heard about him coming from Utah. She really didn't say much about him. I didn't know how many wives he had. I didn't realize that my mom was his sixth wife. There was a lot that I did not know in his past, how really, really dangerous he was. Crazy.
Well, after we met Colleen, we learned from her that she had found a will that her mother had left that Tom Randolph didn't know anything about.
So my will was valid, and his was no longer valid, which really upset him.
His whole idea was to get everything, and that's not what was taking place. He saw his plan slipping away, and that made Colleen very afraid.
I never liked his whole vibe at all. I thought he was very strange, kind of creepy.
There came a point in time where Colleen wanted to change the locks on the house.
Spy. And I was afraid to go by myself.
Should we go get your shoes?
So O'Kelly went with me.
Mm-hmm.
Is this more or less almost like a keep the peace, move out type of situation here with me being here today? And it's a civil issue, and that's what it is.
We're changing out all the locks on the house so Tommy Randolph doesn't have access.
Colleen came in and she saw the tape up on the wall and the blood spatter and things like that. She had more questions, and I answered as many as I could for her.
Because it's more of an oily.
That was my first where I heard of what exactly happened. I only had bits and pieces.
But this is very important to us. It tells us a lot, which is also consistent with...
She knew about Mike Miller being the one who killed her mother.
So she just walked in the house from the garage? Doesn't make sense. Yeah, I mean...
It makes more sense that there's a person in here waiting when your mother comes into the house. It's far, far more consistent with a person being in here laying in wait for your mother to cross over this area in the hallway.
Next thing I would think of logically, then why didn't Michael knew Tommy was going to walk in the door next, shoot him the second he came in the door?
Well, and that's all also consistent with Michael being part of this plan to kill your mother.
I'm looking for some sort of... So we're walking through the house and the front door was left open.
Tom Randolph showed up.
Randolph was standing right in the doorway with this crazy look on his face. And I froze.
Have you got a piece of paper that says I can't be here? No, that's what I thought, so. You're just an aren't you?
Oh, my heart's still going pretty fast. It just scared the crap out of me.
You could see when Colleen tensed up, quite a bit when we knew he was there. And he was immediately agitated. He felt like he could come in and start pushing his way around, and we were like, nope, I'm not having any of it.
And Randolph looked even more upset that I was with O'Kelly.
Have you got a piece of paper that says I can't be here? No, that's what I thought, so. I think I'll stay in my house.
No,
I live here. This is my house address.
No, that's not the way it's going to move then.
You're just an aren't you? Yeah, you really are. I need to get some of my stuff off of you.
No, go ahead.
But what do you mean, I can't get my clothes?
No, that's something you gotta work out with your terms.
He's locked out because he can't get his clothes. And I'm not talking to him. Oh, my heart's still going pretty fast. Just scared the crap out of me.
Rob and I had gathered enough information based on the crime scene and witnesses, video surveillance we had obtained to that point, and had every degree of confidence that we had enough to arrest Thomas Randolph.
We're getting ready to go over to the district attorney's office, go over the case, go over what we have at this point, and see if we have enough.
I'm hopeful, but I'm doubtful. I'm a little more pessimistic than Dean is. I'm not sure we're quite there yet.
We presented the case to Robert Daskus and David Stanton, two of the very experienced district attorneys.
We were hoping to walk out of that meeting with an arrest warrant.
I thought, this is good. We have plenty.
We have this home invasion that occurs on the 8th of May. We have a pretty good idea of when They got home. You know, it was consistent. We presented the facts that we had, that we knew at the time. He lets her out.
In addition to some things that had come to light about Mr. Randolph.
We believe that this was planned months earlier. Over the period of 5 months that Randolph befriends Miller, they're in daily contact with each other. They do all sorts of stuff together, to include day and afternoon of the murder. They went out together shopping for jet skis.
Dean believes that this was a setup by Randolph to use Miller as a pawn to do the dirty work. Then he got rid of the only witness that could tie him to this conspiracy.
You both believe without question that Miller shoots Sharon, and then of course Randolph comes in and plays the hero. You don't think there's any chance that Randolph shoots both?
Well, we don't believe so.
That kind of surprises me. You're telling me that you don't think that Randolph popped the wife?
No.
Let's just walk through it from Randolph's version of events. They have this struggle in the hallway. There's a bunch of shots fired. He wants to make sure the guy who just killed his wife and is in his house is dead. So he goes over and puts a couple rounds in his head.
That's what we thought that night.
And Randolph says during the struggle the mask comes up.
Pushed up a little.
Okay. And does he say at some point that he takes it off of him?
No. He said that when he shot him in the head, did he believe he still had the mask on?
And there's no holes in the mask. There's no holes in the ski mask. There's no bullet holes. There's no blood on it.
Dave, there's so much more to it. There's so much more to it. He's been married. He's been married six times. Four wives are dead.
Wow. Four wives are dead.
In my line of work, I don't believe in coincidences. Obviously, at this point, I don't know a lot of the details about his other wives, both living and dead.
They wanted some time to think about it. It was kind of disappointing. Like, well, maybe I didn't say it right. Maybe I didn't, you know, focus on the right things. But obviously, they weren't getting it at that point. They weren't feeling it.
There were some very strong conclusions that you could draw, but they weren't absolutes.
Rob and I were frustrated. We just couldn't say, okay, that's it. Let's go. You know, let's put the handcuffs on him and take him in.
This is mostly all of his stuff. This is the ammunition. Two giant duffel bags of bullets.
What if he's never arrested?
I'm gonna be afraid. Really afraid. Your parents die, and then all of a sudden, everything is just so overwhelming. You're in charge of everything. What do you do with it, you know? And, I don't sleep good. I have some really strange dreams, nightmares, more involving him. You know, I know I've pissed him off pretty bad by locking him out of the house, and he's not been able to get his stuff for quite a while. We've been rooting through the house and seeing all of his things. I can see why he's so upset now. There's some naked pictures in here. We found some business cards. He's got a lot of attorney's cards. That's his stuff. He was extremely creepy going through his things. Driver's licenses from his ex-wives. It's hard to swallow. It's crazy. Here's his scuba gear. What? shoots that, and then he's got this bulletproof vest going on. I don't know what you need that for. I mean, this was the bedroom. This was his side. He stashes all his drugs and medications in here. This is mostly all of his stuff. This is the ammunition.
He had two giant duffel bags of bullets.
They're those hollow tip bullets.
What if he's never arrested?
Gosh, I don't know. I'm gonna be afraid. Really afraid. Here you go, sweetie. I took some control away from him. I know he's a control freak. I really have faith in the police.
All the things that we were able to put together about him added that credibility to Colleen's fear, that she truly believed that as long as Tom Randolph was free, that she needed to be afraid.
As we were walking into that second meeting with the district attorneys, I mean, we were both hopeful that we'd be able to walk out of there with an arrest warrant for Thomas Randolph.
What a jury is going to know is he claims there's an intruder, he's startled, lucky for him he gets a gun, and the explanation he provides you doesn't make a lot of sense given the physical evidence he gets. Is it any wonder he can't remember exactly where he was when he fired that gun?
I was not happy. I remember sitting there thinking, I don't know how you're not seeing this. I don't know what the reason is.
And so, when I look at it, I say there's no way given that evidence that a jury convicts him of anything with that explanation. I think it's not there.
I tend to agree with Robert. The most critical thing at that juncture is, is there any evidence that's relevant and admissible to the current case that Dean's investigating?
If I'm a defense attorney, yeah, he's panicked.
Well, we got the gal in North Carolina that says that Miller told her that this guy was looking for somebody to kill his wife.
He said, I don't know. He told me he wanted me to kill his wife.
Okay, who does that witness say that that comes from?
From Michael Miller.
From Michael Miller.
And Robert, what's your thought about the statements to Miller about him being solicited to...
I don't think that's ever coming in.
Yeah.
I don't see any way to get around the hearsay. If we get Randolph telling somebody something and that person comes forward, then we've got no problem.
Right.
They told us we didn't have enough. They felt like there was a plausible deniability there for him and that the case just wasn't strong enough, and they didn't want to take a chance of losing it in court. We had a lot more work to do ahead of us.
They go, okay, well, we need to dig deeper.
That means we're going to have to go back through every relationship he ever had, and talk to everyone.
And that we did. There was a lot more that we put together, things that we absolutely never anticipated.
We were determined to keep going, to gather as much information as we needed to put him in cuffs.
So we wanted to know exactly what had happened to each one of his prior wives.
We needed to look at each one of those marriages, each one of those relationships, to see if that would have any bearing on our case. And so we started with wife number one. Catherine, hi. May we come in?
Come on in.
Okay. Do you know if he had an insurance policy on you?
Yes, he did.
After we left the DA's office, we had to just dig as deep as we could into Tom Randolph's life. He'd been married 6 times, and 4 of his wives are dead.
His first wife was still alive. She was married to someone else and was living up in Washington State.
Arriving
We're dealing with a relationship that's pretty old, 25 years old. Hello. Catherine, hi.
Hi.
May we come in?
Come on in.
Okay.
This was probably in the 1970s.
Well, he liked that long hair, didn't he?
Yeah.
How did you meet Thomas Randolph?
I was in high school. I was a senior, and I had a girlfriend, and her boyfriend happened to be roommates.
When did you get married?
August 2nd, 1975. I was 18. He was 20.
And this was where?
This was in Clearfield, Utah. We were married at his parents' house, and I was very drawn to his parents. They were very good to me. He was a very charming and witty person and very intelligent. And I fell for that at first.
And you have two children with him?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Justice and Krista.
Randolph and Kathy had two kids. One, her son's name was Justice. We found that to be rather ironic.
I mean, he didn't hold a steady job for too long. The first sign I saw of things going wrong, I made him a bowl of oatmeal one morning. And because it didn't have sugar on it, he picked it up and threw it against the wall and said, "My mother always put sugar on my oatmeal."
What happened after that, after you saw that first sign?
Well, I think, of course, deteriorated from there. He just, you know, wouldn't quit harassing me. He started seeing other women, doing a lot of drugs, started to deal drugs, was arrested, but his parents bailed him out every time.
Do you know if he had an insurance policy on you?
Yes, he did. We actually divorced in April 7th of 83.
What was the reason why you ended the marriage?
He got really scary and abusive, not physically, but psychologically. He was very narcissistic. He liked to control you, you know.
And then at some point you meet Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And how long after you had started dating did he find out about the relationship?
I think it was pretty soon.
It was pretty soon because we'd had
Her husband Steve had been friends with Thomas Randolph prior to them even getting married.
His reaction was that it was like stealing meat from another man's refrigerator.
You going out with his ex-wife, like you were stealing meat from
his refrigerator.
You had a brief conversation with Detective O'Kelly on the phone, and specifically, I guess there was a conversation that Mr. Randolph had initiated with you where he was asking you about what you'd be willing to do for money, or?
Yes, I did. Okay. He had approached me and asked me if I would kill somebody for money if I knew I could get away with it.
Uh-huh.
And on several occasions, he did approach me and say something like this.
Several occasions?
Several occasions, yes. Not just once, but several times. Looking back, you know, I firmly believe that she was the target.
It shows a pattern, you know, not just the approach, but just kind of, you know, that he's around somebody for a while and then he'll just maybe put something out there and see whether or not they, like you say, whether or not they bite on it, you know.
Yeah.
This is all fitting the pattern. We needed to find out more.
He was still out on the loose. And he was in town.
I was very afraid. I knew he killed her.
I think Colleen had every reason to be afraid. The only thing we could do at that point was just tell her, if you thought you were under immediate threat, call 911. You know, make sure you protect yourself. And we had to tell her that because at that point, there was nothing we could do to restrict Tom Randolph's movement.
I just remember screaming and just dropping to my knees.
Becky Randolph was Tom Randolph's second wife.
I said, "Becky," and she said, "Just come home."
And I said, she's dead, and she just come home.
At this point, with our investigation and now talking to Kathy and Steve, her husband, we're very interested in finding out what had happened with the other wives. Becky Randolph was Tom Randolph's second wife. They were married in 1983. When we first found out about Becky Randolph, we found that it was ruled a suicide. The initial investigation said that it was a suicide.
Yeah, this is Detective Wilson from Las Vegas.
We wanted to get the information about what happened. Was it similar to what we had?
So we had to follow the breadcrumb trail all the way back to Utah and talk to everyone that was still around that was willing to talk to us.
Rob Wilson.
Rose Allred.
Nice to meet you, Rose.
Hi. O'Kelly.
Hi.
Good to meet you.
Come on in.
Okay.
One of the first stops we made in Utah was Becky's aunt, Rosalie Allred. And she has some very interesting things to tell us.
Here's one picture of her. I think that was when she got married.
Becky had confided in Rosalie, and so she was able to remember a lot of information.
Tell me what you know about Tom Randolph and about their relationship.
I just didn't like him. I just didn't like the man. And
did you point to anything?
He was just an arrogant, smartass. I just didn't like him.
Did Becky ever talk to you about him or anything that he was doing to her?
Yeah.
What do you remember about that?
She told me that he had a room down in the basement. And he always kept it locked, and he'd have other girls down there and make her go down and watch them have sex. And I asked her, doesn't it kill you to watch him do that with other girls? And she said, yeah, but I do it because he wants me to.
What really kind of hit me the most is how raw her pain was.
He's really a sick son of a bitch.
One of the things that stood out to me the most was apparently Tom and Becky were having a lot of financial problems.
Their lights were off, they're behind on their rent.
And at some point, they go to Rosalie to borrow some money.
And for some reason, this popped up in my stuff, and I don't know why.
She was able to find a receipt for, I believe it was $2,000 that she had loaned to Becky so that they could get out of debt.
And he took it and paid the insurance premiums.
How do you know that he used that money to pay for the premium?
Because she told me that Tom was bitching because the insurance premium was due on their insurance.
And the life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Tom's major priority was to keep the insurance premiums for Becky Randolph, a perfectly healthy woman, keep her life insurance premiums up to date. For him, that was a priority.
He had three policies out of them.
You remember that he had three?
I know he had three.
Okay. He was a beneficiary of all of them, you know?
Yeah.
Becky was... Her smile was... infectious. She walked into a room and you could do nothing but be happy she was there.
Becky is my first cousin. She's more like a sister. We grew up together.
We were just all sitting around and she kept talking about this guy she met named Tom. She was just really happy to meet him and how cute he was and all this other stuff. So, I mean, he was a real smooth talker.
I thought Thomas Randolph, when I very first met him, was a show-off. He was always telling people how smart he was. Tom was working for a law firm, trying to become an attorney?
At first, they seemed like they were pretty happy, and then things started to get worse.
As the relationship got bad, I said, why don't you leave him? And she would say, I'm so afraid of what Tom's going to do to me if I leave. And she was at my house, and she says, Delia, I need to run to my home in Clearfield just to pick up a few things. She never came home. She never came back. She was shot. She was shot in the head.
And everybody kept telling me that she shot herself. And I said, no, Becky didn't shoot herself. She would never shoot herself.
And I just remember screaming and saying, you've got to be kidding, and just dropping to my knees and crying.
My cousin called and told me to come home. That was at work, told me to come home. And I said, is it Mom? And she said, no. And I said, is it Becky? And she said, just come home. And I said, she's dead, isn't she? Just come home. And she was dead.
The depth of her grief was so profound. It was very clear that justice had not been done in her mind and that there was no peace.
We were finding quite a bit more, and it was painting a clear picture of who we were dealing with in Tom Randolph. We needed to meet with the people that were involved in the original investigation of Becky Randolph's death.
There were a lot of things that, you know, was a red flag to me. Just by looking at it, she'd have to be on her head and ambidextrous in order to pull that trigger. There was no way in my mind that could happen.
The Davis County Justice Center to speak to Deputy District Attorney Steve Maiden.
And the goal is to find out everything about how Becky died.
We're going to take you back many, many, many years.
Many years ago.
He was at the scene, and when he looked at it, I mean, his impression overall was that it was a suicide.
I remember going into the house. It was a newer house at the time. When we had gotten into the house, she was upstairs in a bedroom, and they had found a suicide note, or what we thought was a suicide note, on the kitchen counter, and then she was upstairs in the bedroom. She was lying on the waterbed. She was covered up to the top, just below her breast, with a blanket. Literally, I think we all walked in. We had a note. We had her on the bed. We had a gun in her hand. We had a gunshot wound to the head. We're saying, you know, this is like a suicide. You know, and so from that point, basically how we started treating the thing as being a suicide.
We also met with, you know, my counterpart, the lead investigator in the case, Dick Martin.
There were a lot of things that, you know, was a red flag to me, such as the position of the hands, the position where the gun fell.
He felt uncomfortable with calling it a suicide, that there were things about it that troubled him.
He related to us about his concerns about the positioning of the gun and how he felt that it was odd.
Because the way her head was like this, with the, now you gotta think of the impression of the barrel be reversed.
Mm-hmm.
So now my sight's here, instead of here, which is totally abnormal. So now she's like this, upside down, laying like this to pull the trigger. Ain't happening. Just by looking at it, she'd have had to be on her head and ambidextrous in order to pull that trigger. There was no way in my mind that could happen.
He went back to the crime scene. He went back to investigate further.
It was his understanding that the scene had been secured.
I was really upset when I went back to the house. I was under the impression that the county attorney's office had locked the house down. by the time I could get my warrant in order to get back in there and do things, everything that I wanted to do was gone.
Thomas Randolph had come in and basically scoured the place clean.
Carpet was up, walls painted, you know, I mean, you name it, it was nice.
Becky Randolph's death was declared a suicide. So now Tom Randolph not only gets to go on with his life, but he also cashed in on a life insurance policy close to $500,000. Becky's death remained a suicide for the next couple of years until Lieutenant Scott Connolly from Ogden, Utah, got involved in the investigation. So we needed to talk to Scott Connolly. So we went to Ogden Police Department.
Detectives with the Las Vegas Metro, we're here for Lieutenant Connolly.
I'll never forget the day that, you know, my phone rang. I was a lieutenant, you know, with the police department at that time. And, you know, it was Las Vegas PD, and they wanted to know about Tom Randolph. And I thought, holy hell, here we go again. I first heard of Tom Randolph in the detective division. And this guy wanted to be a major drug player in the Ogden area. Everybody would tell me, this guy is so enthralled with the Scarface movie that he demanded that they all call him Tony Montana.
Wow. This is all your stuff?
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's big.
Oh. I haven't been through this stuff in a long, long time.
He had all this information about Tom Randolph.
Same look, man, right yeah. there. Look at
same
that.
Same kind of same look.
He developed a huge case file.
The way he got involved in the Becky Randolph investigation is that a woman told him that her husband had been approached by Thomas Randolph about killing Becky.
Her husband's name was Eric Tarantino. Tom Randolph had befriended him years earlier. He ended up starting to groom him to kill Becky Randolph.
Eric and I started off on a conversation, you know, about, you know, what had taken place. He and Tom were really close. Eric started telling me of, you know, the different plots to take Becky out, that he had Becky insured.
Tom and Eric had developed like four or five different plans of, you know, taking her out, basically killing her for a profit.
Because Eric Tarantino was such an important person in Becky Randolph's murder investigation, he also became important to us because of the similarities between Becky's death and Sharon's death.
After talking to Scott Connolly, it became very apparent that we needed to talk to Eric Tarantino.
There was little innuendos here and there, and then just a point blank, I want you to kill my wife. This is exactly what he said. You know way too much to say no, so it's you or her.
Tarantino was somebody who Tom Randolph befriended and over a period of time had groomed him to kill Becky Randolph.
Because they got a 7:45 flight on Thursday.
And so it was very apparent that Eric Tarantino could play a major role in moving forward in our investigation.
It sucks. I hate flying.
The whole time that we're trying to gather information, we realized that Tom Randolph is free. He's out and able to do whatever he wanted to do. my partner Rob Wilson and I end up getting on another plane, and we're off to New Hampshire to meet with Eric Tarantino. Really appreciate you coming, Dean. Rob Wilson, my partner.
He's kind of a wise guy, kind of character.
How do you know Thomas Randolph?
I met him. He was the foreman in a cabinet shop that I worked at. Tom and I had become good friends while I was working. We remained good friends after.
Initially, it was an admiration type of thing. And then he kind of fell into that trap that Thomas Randolph probably laid for him.
It started with him coming up and having odd jobs, like go by the house and shovel the driveway, and come in and have dinner. And I started getting to know his wife. Some of the jobs that I did for Tom was collecting money. He dealt drugs to everybody. He dealt drugs to police officers, individuals on the street. I'd go and collect money for them when they didn't pay.
What kind of drugs?
Everything.
Like?
Pharmaceutical, marijuana, cocaine, Valium, things like that.
There came a point in time where he's talking to you about killing somebody. You had said something about that. Why don't you go back to that? How did all that transpire? Describe that for me.
Just, little things there, here and there about killing somebody for collecting insurance. Would I be capable of shooting somebody? It was just one thing after another. It was little innuendos here and there, and then just a point blank, I want you to kill my wife.
When he talks to you about killing his wife, tell me how that took place. Where were you? What were you doing? Do you remember?
We were shooting guns in, Weber Canyon. He had a 22 with a silencer. We shot it a couple times, and he said, I want you to kill my wife. And no was the first thing out of my mouth. But we'd gone through so many scenarios. When he actually said who it was, and I said no, it was real simple. And this is exactly what he said. You know way too much to say no, so it's you or her. Well, I wasn't ready to die, so I played the game.
As we listened to him tell his story,
yes,
the similarities with what we knew about Michael Miller were striking. I mean, you could almost envision Mike Miller sitting across the table from us in the park instead of Eric Tarantino.
From there, it was kind of like being a hostage situation. The minute I said no, everything in our relationship changed. I didn't trust him anymore. I became fearful of him. Every time he showed up, I didn't know if I was going to be dead. Like I said, I'd walk into a room, he'd put a gun to my head. Loaded or not, I don't know. Boom, blow a chair away. Guess it was loaded. I walked into his house one day, he walked up behind me with chloroform on a rag, grabbed a hold of me, and the next thing I know, I'm laying on the floor and he's standing over me laughing. I did whatever he asked me to do. I mean, we went out so many different times practicing misfiring guns.
So you're practicing an accidental shooting where she would get killed?
Exactly. If we were out camping and they were in the tent, he could get up and go to the bathroom. I'd be sleeping in the blazer, knock the truck in the neutral, and it rolls over the tent and runs her over and kills her. Pushing her down in a canyon with a raging river in it. Shooting her. Accidental, non-accidental. Just walking in and putting a hole in her. Sliding the rifle into the case and it goes off. We did, the fire scenario. That was discussed for over a month. How it could be done, when she was sleeping, where it could start, in the trailer.
It was almost like a battered wife syndrome. He was scared. He was afraid.
On any of these, he was afraid, and no. Rightly so. Tom Randolph's a dangerous person.
There was nobody to tell. Tom dealt to police officers, he knew judges, he knew lawyers, he knew everybody that I would have turned to say, okay, this guy's out of his mind, somebody get me out of here. I never had the attention to kill him, Becky, ever.
He developed a relationship with Becky Randolph. he started to care about her, that she was a human being. He couldn't see himself doing it. He couldn't follow through. And that brought him to the point where he knew that he had to tell her. So he ended up calling her.
I said, Becky, look, Tom's going to kill you. He's got life insurance policies in the bottom drawer of his bureau at his mother's house. I've seen them. They're under a yellow sweater. I knew when I made that phone call, I either had to run or I was going to be dead. I just packed up and ran. My wife called me, I want to say a year later. She didn't say hi. She said she's dead. And I dropped the phone.
We saw the arrest on TV. We're all just thinking they have to find Tom guilty. It's obvious that he's guilty.
How are you feeling?
Wonderful.
When Becky Ray Randolph died 2 years ago from a gunshot wound to the head, Clearfield police called it apparent suicide. But today, police arrested Randolph's husband on charges of murder.
Scott Connolly brought it back to the forefront and was able to get it to the point where Randolph was arrested for Becky's murder.
Talking with Eric Tarantino, I basically confirm that what Tom's plan is, what's his involvement in. I want to right the wrong, that this wasn't a suicide, that this was a homicide.
Officers took Thomas Randolph Jr. into custody after new evidence implicated him in the shooting.
We saw the arrest on TV. We felt joy. Finally, Tom's going to be paying for what he did to Becky. Finally, it's going to come to the light that he did kill Becky.
I was pretty excited. I was hoping for the best. I kind of relieved that maybe justice would be done.
Randolph is suspected of concocting an elaborate scheme to kill his wife and collect on her life insurance policy.
Eric Tarantino is the prosecution's star witness.
Randolph knew that Tarantino was the key witness against him. Everything for the Utah case hinged on Eric Tarantino's testimony. And Tom, of course, knew that. And so he hatched a plan to have him killed. He ended up having a conversation with what he thought was a hitman, but it ended up being an undercover police officer.
Tarantino is in protective custody. He says his life is in danger for testifying.
Tom is on trial for killing Becky, while at the same time, he's under investigation for trying to have Eric Tarantino killed.
The attorneys in the case paint vastly different views of this trial. The defense says it's suicide, not murder. But the prosecution says it's more complicated than that.
This trial began in April of 89. I was in the courtroom. I remember listening to them going through the trial. We all knew Tom killed her. Becky would never have killed herself. Never.
The prosecution also referred to this man's testimony. His name is Eric Tarantino, who told the court that he and Randolph rehearsed ways to kill Becky and make it look accidental.
Tarantino, a former friend of Randolph, claims the murder defendant once jumped up on a bed and began singing along with the Rod Stewart song.
The lyric says, "Or should I act quite cold and deliberate, or maybe blow out her brains with a bullet?"
We were shocked. I just remember feeling so much hate, you know, with Tom sitting up there. Just so much hate.
The 34-year-old Randolph testified for more than 2 hours and in a long and rambling narrative described marriage to a woman he said was disturbed, depressed, and dependent on drugs.
It was horrible. Because, I mean, we knew Becky was addicted to drugs, but we knew it was him that got her addicted. You got her there. You're the one that got her addicted to it. You know she didn't commit suicide. You know you did it.
KUTV's Michael Rothman is standing by now with details of tonight's verdict in Farmington. Michael?
Michelle, we were just informed a few moments ago that the jury has returned a verdict.
We're outside, the family, and we're just all very tense. We're all just thinking they have to find Tom guilty. It's obvious that he's guilty. And just waiting, waiting, and then we get called back in there.
The jury ruled Becky Randolph died from her own hand and not her husband's.
I just need to thank the jury for being so attentive.
When we heard not guilty, you can't even explain how that feels. It was horrible.
When it came back that he wasn't guilty, that was tough. And then to be so arrogant about it was even tougher.
How are you feeling?
Wonderful.
He's evil. He's truly evil. He's a smart man and he manipulates people. To see my mom break down and to see my grandma and Becky's mom, it was just devastating for everybody in the family.
I think it's very unfair and unjust. He's guilty. And he's just going to kill somebody else's daughter, so beware.
When that verdict came in, I mean, it was like your gut just dropped out. Tom Randolph walked out. He basically gave me the, middle finger, like, hey, I'm going home free. But I knew I had the ace in the hole. You know, we had the conspiracy to commit murder charge, against Eric Tarantino, where he wanted Tarantino killed for, testifying in the case. And he wasn't going home free and ultimately pled guilty to it. After Tom had served his time, he went back into the Tom role. Randolph decides to sue Davis County, Clearfield PD, and Ogden PD for libel and slander. So the decision was to pay him off. He gained monetarily off that whole, event. Settlement came and then he was gone. That gut feeling comes out again. God, if I would have stopped him the first time, what could I have done different? Why? Man, it's almost bringing me to tears thinking how he destroyed so many lives and how many lives have been affected since then.
You were at one time married to somebody by the name of Thomas Randolph, is that correct?
Correct. He was cleaning the gun and I wasn't very far away from him at all, and it went off.
Jury ruled Becky Randolph died from her own hand and not her husband's.
After Randolph was acquitted for the murder of his second wife, Becky Randolph, he met his third wife, Leona. They ultimately ended up moving to Indiana.
We don't know a lot about her. They were only married for about 11 months. Then they divorced. She died approximately a decade later from cancer.
Then it wasn't too long after Leona that he met his fourth wife, and that's Gaina. We are going to Nineveh, Indiana, to talk to Gaina, Randolph's only other surviving wife.
Thank you.
doing?
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
You were at one time married to somebody by the name of Thomas Randolph, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. How did you meet Tom Randolph?
Through an ad and date thing in the newspaper.
Okay, so there's a section in the newspaper for people that kind of was before the internet?
Correct. We went out for a period of time. Of course, I mean, just he was very nice, brought flowers and all this kind of stuff. And then the next thing I know, I'm stupid enough to marry him.
All right, and you mentioned that there was a an insurance policy that he had taken out on you?
He said that he was taking it out within a month or so.
She told us it wasn't long after they were married that Randolph had gotten involved in a bar fight that resulted in a shooting with a couple of people wounded.
Right. I just remember a phone call from the police department saying that he had been arrested.
So she had a friend of hers on the police department that knew a lot of the history relating to Randolph. And he was communicating some of that to Gaynor.
They had told me, because they were asking me all these kind of questions, that they had dug up information and asked me if he'd taken out a life insurance policy on me. And I told them, yes, that he had. And then they explained to me about an incident that happened in Utah that he had been under suspicion as far as murder there of a wife. And I had no knowledge of any of that.
Now all the warning signs are going off in Gaynor's head.
And then shortly thereafter is when he was cleaning a gun and it had gone off.
All right, so can you tell me about that? How'd that happen?
He was sitting at the dining room table and was cleaning the gun, and I wasn't very far away from him at all, and it went off.
About how far do you think you were between, as far as
I would say it would be the distance between him and I.
Like about 3 feet?
And it went off, and it was just, you know, within a foot away from me, and it was a hole in the floor. And he said that he didn't realize it was loaded, and it went off.
What did you do?
Well, I mean, of course, I started yelling, and I was scared. And it wasn't too long after that he went to work, and I packed up my stuff, and I was gone.
Okay.
I mean, I went to hiding, basically.
She was real smart for getting out of there. As a matter of fact, we learned that he had approached a man, somebody he befriended, and then ultimately popped the question, would you be willing to kill somebody for money? And we ended up going out to Kentucky and speaking with that man, and that was Glenn Morrison. You were describing earlier that he was kind of into guns and things like that?
Yeah.
And did you ever see these guns that he had?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And where did you see him at?
At his house. Had some in the safe. He carried some in his briefcase, the truck with the car.
He mapped out everything that Tom Randolph had planned. And it was an exact match to what we had in Las Vegas with Sharon Randolph.
He asked me something about making some quick money. If I needed a car, you know, he said, well, I can give you a car if you do. You make some quick money. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, my wife, he said, I got a lot of interest, boy. He said, shoot her. And shoot me in the leg. I said, you're out of your mind, man. I said, I ain't had nothing to do with that.
I'm thinking, this is the same conversation that Tom Randolph had with Mike Miller. I'm sitting here looking at Mike Miller across the table from me.
If I understand correctly what you were explaining to us about this whole plan that he had, that he proposed to you, he was trying to make it look like a robbery.
Yeah.
Where you came in,
right,
and forced him to open the safe,
right,
and that you had shot the wife during this,
right,
this robbery, and then shot him in the leg.
Yeah, to make it
and then
the
you
safe.
Stole the car.
Right.
As you were leaving.
Right. When he opened that safe, he had a gun in there too. If I did that, he'd shot me. And if she done shot, he don't need me no more. It'd be perfect alibi. No witness.
What he related to us as the plan that he had with Randolph was an exact match to what we had in Las Vegas.
Thank you for your hospitality.
You guys have a nice trip.
Right, thank you. Thanks.
But Glenn Morrison wasn't buying it. He believed that Tom Randolph would double cross him.
He probably prevented himself from being the Mike Miller of Kentucky.
Oh.
Or Indiana, you know what I mean? Because he figured it out.
He was smart enough to see it.
A little bit further ahead than Mike Miller did.
Yeah,
I think what makes Thomas Randolph stand out is the calculated nature of grooming his victims and grooming his accomplices. He uses people, and when he's done using them, he tosses them aside. That's who he is, and that's who he will always be.
Now we need to look into Tom Randolph's fifth wife, Frances Randolph. And in many ways, it was one of the creepiest. It was one of the most difficult to stomach.
I love you, Tom.
He just said, can you give me and your mom a minute? I left the room, and like 45 minutes later, he came out and told me that my mom passed away. What's the chance that she passed away in the time that I was out of that room?
You were at one time married to...
We're working down this list of Tom Randolph's wives, both living and dead. Everything's been consistent so far. We're getting this, just this pattern of finding women, marrying them, getting insurance money on them. And then after a period of time, he's finding somebody to kill the wife. We were racing against the clock, in our opinion, because Randolph was free. We've got to get this guy in custody.
Keep to the left on I-70.
Now we need to look into Tom Randolph's fifth wife.
The fifth wife was named Frances.
We knew that Frances was dead. The question was, why? How did that happen? Her sisters lived in Edinburgh, Indiana, so Rob Wilson and I went there to speak with them.
This is taking us to 502 or 505 at work 111.
Destination on the left in 0.3 miles.
We are in Edinburgh to meet with Carolyn and Hilda.
Come in.
Hello. Hi, Hilda. How are you doing?
And this is my husband, Arnold.
About how long before Frances and Tom were married?
Well, he kind of pushed her into marrying after she met him. He wanted to get married right off, and she had to get a divorce, so... It was, I'll say, 6 months after they met, they married.
What we learned was that Frances had a heart condition. It was serious, but not so serious that it would require immediate surgery. But Tom Randolph convinced her that she needed to get the surgery.
She had surgery, come out of recovery, and was doing fine, was setting up, eating, talking, and then something went wrong.
My mom was my best friend. She always was right there by my side. And my mom was short and really pretty and sweet, the sweetest person you've ever met. My mom moved in with Tom in Taylorsville, Indiana. And we stayed there until we moved to Clearfield, Utah. He seemed like picture-perfect dad. Put me in gymnastics, put me in cheerleading, taught me how to skate. He was like the role model dad to me. But him and my mom would slowly start fighting more and more. She had her heart surgery, getting a valve replaced, and she came out of surgery and it seemed like she was doing okay. She was doing fine for I don't know how many days. And then one day Tom asked me to leave the room. He just said, can you give me and your mom a minute? And I left the room, and like 45 minutes later, he came out and told me that my mom passed away. And then right after that, he held me on his knees and he was boohooing about not another wife. I can't lose another one. And then the doctor came in, asked if he wanted an autopsy. My stepdad said no, he didn't want my mom cut up into a bunch of little pieces. And that was that. And then he had her cremated. Nathan was right. He should have had an autopsy. What's the chance that she passed away in the time that I was out of that room? When I was just in there talking to her in 30, 45 minutes when she was just fine. It don't make sense.
He told me she died on the operating table.
Francis's death was ruled not suspicious. It was considered a medical death that occurred in a medical facility post-surgery. And even though it was not ruled suspicious, Francis's sisters believed it was very suspicious.
My sister was dying before she ever went into surgery. Her face was swollen. I just think she was being poisoned before she ever went in. I don't think she had a chance.
There's no way for us to go back and look at maybe your suspicions of her having been poisoned or drugged or, you know, anything of that nature. We can't go back now and do an analysis to see whether or not he had her cremated.
And this seemed like everybody he's ever around, these women come up dead, he comes up with money.
He actually profited in not only from life insurance on her, but also he sued the hospital and was able to get some money from the hospital that way also.
We don't know the exact amount, but we heard from Francis's sisters that could have been up to $1.2 million.
And that scumbum, whatever he got. So see, every time there's money, he's always getting money.
Francis's sister produced a videotape. And that videotape was of Francis basically given a last will and testament.
You're going to show us what you had?
I've never watched this because I just feel like I can't bear to watch it.
Right.
This is what they tell me, those that have seen it, that they can kind of hear him in the background coaching.
I did watch that tape, and it's obvious that Randolph was coaching Francis.
You want me to go ahead and do it now?
Uh-huh. And this is Francis Louise Randolph, and I'm making this tape so that people will know what I want for Rachel, for myself, when I pass away. I would like for Tom to raise Rachel because he's stepped up to her. And Tommy, I hope you never have to look at this tape because I hope we do it and put it away because I love you too much to think someday I won't be it.
Asshole.
I love you, Tommy.
What do you want done with yourself?
And for my burial, I would like to be cremated and put along with Tom in a place. I don't want to be separated from it, so please, Tommy, do what you think is best because I know you do what's right for me.
Who does that? Setting up a video camera and having her sit there and explain what she wants done with her body. Who would do that? So now we've gone through all of Tom Randolph's wives, both living and dead.
We were very, very hopeful that we would be able to get an arrest warrant and make an arrest in this case.
I worry all the time about my safety and my kids.
It's the moment of truth, right?
Chasing someone like Thomas Randolph, it is satisfying, but there is a level of fear that he could get away. That is a huge fear when you're conducting these investigations. We finally felt we had enough to get an arrest warrant for the murder of Sharon Randolph.
Today's date is September 9th, and we are heading up to Dave Stanton's office to discuss the completion of the affidavit and are being ready to submit the case.
Hey, we're out here.
Thanks, Matt.
It's the moment of truth, right?
Tarantino said that he and Randolph practiced having an accidental discharge with a rifle.
We told him about what happened with our meetings in Utah when we were able to talk, you know, in depth about conversation with Eric Tarantino, Glenn Morrison, and it was an exact match to what we had in Las Vegas with Sharon Randolph.
He talked about Randolph wanting Miller to kill his wife for him. Flat out, that's what she says.
Yes.
You know, one of the things I wanted to talk about today is talk over some strategies about pulling the trigger when we do grand jury versus prelim.
The complexity of the case primarily was the reason that I decided to take it to the grand jury. This was going to be something that we needed witnesses from several different states to fly in.
And that would take months.
Nine months pregnant, going on 40 weeks. I'm short-tempered. I've lost patience. I'm losing faith. I worry. I worry all the time. About my safety, my kids. He's a crazy man. I think he's desperate. I think he's got a real hate for women. He's free.
There's arguments over the property. Ultimately, there's decisions made and agreements made between Colleen and Randolph as to what property he can remove from the house.
He was allowed to come and get just his personal belongings. I did not go. I did not want to be present for that, even though I knew the police were going to be there and the lawyers, and it would have been safe, but I couldn't see him again. And watch him taking things out of my mom's house. My husband went. Homicide detectives, my attorney, his attorney.
We need to be careful. We're there to keep the peace, but we also knew that Tom Randolph traveled with guns.
Both parties are here now, so but there still could be weapons in the house. And so we gotta keep an eyeball on this guy while he's getting everything out of here. We're looking at a man who's planned months and months in advance to kill somebody.
When Randolph came to the house, we had a surprise for him.
We're going to grand jury him for two counts of murder. I'm serving him with a Markham notice.
It's called a Markham notice. It's a notice of indictment.
It is a formal procedure that is based upon Nevada law to give the target of the grand jury notice of our intent to present the case to them.
I'll need to talk to you for a minute, Mr. Randolph. To be in serve with the notice, we're indicting you for two counts of murder and conspiracy to commit murder.
Right.
Oh, this is a notice that we're seeking indictment. So we'll be going to grand jury later.
Okay.
We're at the back of a vehicle, and his reaction was pretty much, all right.
All right, I just need your signature right here.
He was allowed to leave. I mean, we weren't having additional contact with Randolph. All we could do was wait.
Down on the ground, on the ground!
Yes, I got him! You're done to me!
Yes.
It's Katie Lynn Beyer. Born September 17th. Say hi. Katie, say hi. 4 weeks today, huh? She was born on Wednesday. She's a little piggy. That actually hit me the day after when she was born. So my mom was so excited to have a granddaughter. She was thrilled. She loved being a grandma, but she was really hoping for a girl. So it was hard. It's very hard. It's hard now, not having her here. I miss her.
So it took several months for the grand jury to come back, and it is now early January, 8 months after Sharon and Mike Miller were killed. And we finally got the arrest warrant for Tom Randolph. I'm telling you, I don't think the ink was dry, and we were on our way to jump in the car and drive up to Clearfield, Utah.
Thomas Randolph was living with his mother up in Utah, and so we reached out to the local police department up there and got some detectives on board. That was a long drive. We drove up almost basically all night.
Did I turn here?
It was freezing cold, I remember that.
Not sure where it's telling me to turn. Here?
There was snow and ice all over the ground. Located the residence.
I'm excited, man. I'm also kind of nervous, you know.
Cautiously optimistic.
Well, right now we're in Layton having some breakfast right next to Clearfield. But right after we get done with this, we're getting some things in place and getting a team together that is going to take him into custody and get him booked into a local facility.
You want to sit on it at all and try and wait and watch? If not, we'll set up a perimeter and call in the boys and get him that way.
Perimeter.
Rob and I kind of stayed out toward the street. It didn't go as smoothly as Tom Randolph probably would have expected.
Watch that side door. Hello? Can I talk to you real quick? Put your hands on your head right now. Put your hands on your head right now. On your head. Keep on it.
Watch it.
Come out.
You could see that he kept his right hand behind the door frame, and he refused to show his hands.
Taser. Let me see. Taser.
Now
on the ground.
Oh, my God.
That's just
touching me.
Oh. On your belly.
Ow.
Hands behind your back.
My hand. Oh, my God. You fool. Ah, what are you doing?
You're under arrest.
I understand it. Oh, my God. Oh, Jesus. Oh.
Pull his pants up. Let's get him up.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Stand up and walk.
Let's get
him out of the house.
Walk.
You're
killing me. I'm pissing.
Walk.
Oh, walk. Jesus.
Really quick on the sidewalk. Walk, all right? Walk it slow. Let's walk.
Jesus. Yeah, take me.
Hold on. Let's double cuff me. But I'm keeping Taser on, so.
Tom Randolph was arrested for the murders of Sharon Randolph and Mike Miller. I loved it. Rob and I were, I was so glad that it went the way it did.
It was pretty satisfying to finally see that happen, knowing the type of person he is and predator that he really is.
You should have shown me your hands, brother.
I couldn't let go, you stupid. I tried to tell you that. I couldn't have made it much plainer, could I? I'm disabled. I can't let go of the door.
Okay.
I'm going to run him to the hospital and get a medical clearance because he says I can't walk from the arrest. Yeah. We're going to cover CYA.
Yeah, that's
and,
no problem.
We're going to get the medical release real quick at the hospital. After we get that, then we'll go to the jail. So.
Okay.
I do remember his mother coming out. She approached the vehicle, and she seemed very confused as to what was going on.
What did you do to him?
He refused to show his hands when he was ordered to do so and to put his hands on top of his head.
I think that was a little rough there when I told you I couldn't let go of the door. I was holding myself up.
Thomas, you understand that I was there to arrest you on homicide warrants, correct?
You seem to speak pretty good English right now.
Yeah. You understand I was there to arrest you on a homicide warrant, right?
I don't remember me resisting.
Are you a gun enthusiast? Do you have guns?
Of course I've got guns.
Okay,
I have one in your face? No, Thomas, but you had one in mine.
Thomas, I'm not taking any chances when you won't show me your hands.
My hand was on the door.
Your left hand was on the door, your right hand was behind the door frame, and I don't know if you have a gun in that right hand. That's what happened. That's why you were tased, and that's why you were brought out the way you were. You failed to follow instructions. That's what happened.
Yeah, you're jerking me off my feet, but that's okay. That's how they all do it.
My safety's paramount. You understand?
It's a completely circumstantial murder case.
So they ain't got all they got's just somebody saying this, somebody saying that.
It's gotta happen. She has to be stopped.
This is the Tommy Show, live from Las Vegas.
There was a lot of women. There was a lot of women.
I did morning counsel.
We lose, this guy dies.
I got nothing to hide.
That was a f*** you to everybody in that courtroom.
I love you, son.
I will be acquitted. I've told you this from day one, have I not?